episode is supported by True Leaf Market, sellers of heirloom and organic garden seeds since 1974. We all know keeping your soil in good heart is vital for good harvests, and now is a great time to rehab your garden by growing a cover crop. Cover crops improve soil quality in a sustainable way, boosting biomass and soil bacteria, adding nutrients, attracting beneficial insects, improving soil structure, and so much more. To get your free PDF of True Leaf Market's Beginner's Guide to Growing Cover Crops, visit trueleafmarket.com and search for Cover Crop Guide. And you can order your cover crops online now at trueleafmarket.com using promo code OTL15 to save 15% on cover crop seeds. That's trueleafmarket.com. Enter OTL15 for 15% off cover crops. Some restrictions apply. See the show notes for details. Greetings, plant fans. My name is Jane Perrone, and this is On the Ledge podcast. Yes, I'm back. How are you diddling? I am diddling within acceptable parameters, and I'm so delighted to be back with the first episode after my month-long break in August. And I've heard from many of you during my break about how much you were looking forward to this first episode. So welcome. Let's get on with some planty chat. And in this episode, I'll be talking to Lisa Eldred Steinkoff about flowering houseplants, much overlooked and rather glorious, in my opinion, and I think Lisa agrees. Plus, I'll be answering a question about intergeneric hybrids. Ooh. Couple of updates on things. Bad news first. I went away on holiday. I left my delightful little cute nubs of Euphorbia abyssa, and I forgot to do the plastic bag up properly, and I came back to ghost Euphorbia abyssas. They totally got fried. It was very hot while I was away, and so they are gone. This is what sometimes happens when you're sowing things from seed. Really disappointing, but hey, it happens, and I'll go again. Thanks to those of you who are continuing to use the OTL Sow Along hashtag and sharing your cool OTL Sow Along projects with me. It's always lovely to see. And Merrystem UK on Instagram has been far more successful with their Euphorbia abyssa seedlings. Thank you for tagging me on that. Great to see that you've done so well with yours. And I'm going to have to try again next year after my disaster of frying my seedlings. And congratulations to listener Ezra, who managed to grow a syningia from seed and get first prize in its category at the Minnesota State Horticultural Society. Well done, Ezra. What a great performance. And my good news? Well, I came back from holiday to discover that my Hoya villosa had produced a peduncle. Oh my gosh, this was exciting. So a peduncle is just a botanical term for the little stalk from which Hoyas produce flowers. They look a little bit like, well, on most Hoyas, they look a little bit like a cigarette with a burnt end. But on villosa, they are kind of very long and strange looking so far. I've never even seen the flowers of villosa as a photograph or a picture. So I'm really interested to see what these flowers are going to look like. I will keep you posted on that. And if you remember back to the croton episode, my croton, which struggled for a while, is finally doing well. I will post a picture of that on my Instagram, the before and after. You can check me out on Instagram at j.l.perrone. Now let's crack on with my interview today. I'm joined by Lisa Eldred Steinkoff, aka the houseplant guru. Now, you may remember Lisa from previous episodes. I talked to her about plants for low light, many episodes ago, and she's back to talk about her new book, Bloom.
Hi, everyone. I'm so happy to be here today. I'm Lisa Eldred Steinkopf, the houseplant guru, and I am excited to be talking to Jane on the Ledge podcast about blooming houseplants.
Yeah, let's get our houseplants blooming. In fact, just before I came in here to do this interview, my husband said to me, "What are you talking about today?" And I said, "Oh, flowering houseplants." And he said, "This may seem like a stupid question, but don't all houseplants flower?" And I was like, "That's not a stupid question at all. That's a really sensible question." But I feel like houseplants that we grow specifically for their flowers are rather underrated. So I'm very glad that you've written this book that hopefully will start to change that. Why do you think the current trend for houseplants has somewhat left flowering houseplants behind?
Well, I think, number one, everybody's an aroid crazy person right now. And those do flower. Me neither. I say that and then I look around, I'm like, oh, I have quite a few. But anyway, they're not me. And they do flower, but if you're lucky, but usually not. But I think that everybody thinks that flowering houseplants are harder to grow. They need a greener thumb. I don't know what they're thinking, but really there's a lot that are really easy to bring into bloom. And who doesn't want blooms?
I think sometimes people think that leaves look somehow, there's a bit of a sort of a reputation of flowering houseplants as being kind of something your grandmother might grow. And I speak as somebody who's old enough to be a grandmother just about. I think like all fashions and trends, it changes and it's not based on any reality. It's just our preconceptions.
Right.
And there are just so many amazing flowering houseplants out there. I think there is start of change. I remember seeing an article about one of the trendy American publications online did a piece about African violets and how wonderful they are. And I thought, wow, things are changing. People are reassessing these plants, which is great. So that's hopefully your book will bring more change.
I was so excited because in my new book, I asked them if I could have a picture my grandma took in probably, I don't even know, 40, 50 years ago. So just their little Kodak, camera. And it's a picture of her windowsill with all of her African violets on it in the kitchen. And I'm like, can I use that? And they're like, yeah, we scanned it in. And so her picture is in my book of her little windowsill in her kitchen with her African violets, which she just doted on. She would be amazed at what there is now with the she didn't have variegated foliage. Some of those African violets, I wouldn't care if they never bloomed. They have such beautiful foliage.
Yes, I agree. And you're right that I have precious memories as well of my mum growing African violets. I'm sure that she would say, oh, I'm terrible at growing them, but they always seem to do really well. In fact, when I visited her in Canada in the spring, I repotted her African violet and they didn't have any plant pots. So I had to repot it into a yogurt pot with some holes whacked in the bottom.
Grandmas were in clay pots, which, I've written a blog post about that because a lot of times if the leaves rest on that clay pot, the salts will disintegrate the leaf stem or the petiole, I should say. Then she had them in, we had margarine tubs over here, little, mm-hmm. what our margarine always came in. And those were the saucers. And she grew them beautifully there. And she was always starting new ones in baby food jars with foil. And
just run that past me again. So if they're in a terracotta pot, the salts will end up damaging the petioles of the yes. leaf stalks. So really, that's a reason not to put them, to give them plastic instead then by this or ceramic.
I would. Yes. I don't use clay pots. I mean, I love clay pots and a lot of people do use them, but if they, and a lot of people bottom water African violets. So of course they're drawing those salts and those minerals up into the clay pot. And if it, it gets that right crusty stuff on the edge, if you let your African violet leaf sit on that or rest on that, it will collapse.
Oh, that's interesting. I've never tried growing them in terracotta, so that hasn't been a problem. I do love terracotta. I grow all my cacti and succulents in them. But I did have a real struggle today trying to get a cactus, a baby golden barrel cactus out of a terracotta pot.
Ooh.
And it was just a battle royal with lots of me being spiked. But
yes,
that's another story. Flowering houseplants, there's a huge spectrum that falls within this category. Things that from everything from orchids to gisneriads to gardenias and all kinds of plants, both trendy and perhaps overlooked in the current climate. What is it that you look for in a really good houseplant, though, that one that flowers?
I really lately have just been so into the scent, you know, and they bloom at night, and I have my sunroom open to our family room where we're at night, and the smell from the, I don't know if you saw, I have an Epiphyllum oxypetalum, you know, the night blooming cereus that has been blooming. It's bloomed three times this year, and it's just like heaven out there. And then I have a Hoya pubicalyx that is just, it only has like three or four blooms, but it makes that whole room just smell amazing. So I never really thought about looking for scent, but now it's like, that's interesting. That's another thing to look for, because who doesn't want something to smell really good? But I like them to bloom a long time. Like, I know they're in every grocery store now, pretty much every store you go to, but I love Phalaenopsis orchids. I mean, they just bloom forever.
They are great plants. There's a reason why they're so popular,
yes,
right?
Exactly.
That they just make really good plants.
Right.
And as you say, those flowers just stick around so long.
I have to say they're not the most attractive plant, which, you know, I don't think there's, well, I guess there are some ugly plants, but not really. I love them all. Once they're done flowering, then I move them to a different room. I just have them out when they're blooming.
There are, in this country, a few scented Phalaenopsis now. Have you had a chance to smell any of those?
I haven't, but I guess I've never actually, I mean, it wasn't enough smell to make me stop and like, oh, I smell something good in here that's not the Hoya or not whatever else. But so I haven't.
It's not that strong. It's not like a Hoya flowering. It's more subtle, but it is nice. There's one which has got kind of a nutmeg scent.
Oh.
And I love the smell of nutmeg.
Me too.
I mean, like, if I could spend the rest of my life living on one food, it would probably be custard tart.
Wow.
And the smell of nutmeg just drives me mad. So, yeah, that one's a really nice one. And it's got a kind of nutmeggy pale apricot petals as well. But I don't know how widely available that one is. But, yeah, it's subtle. It's a little bit subtle, but it is nice. But it's a very personal thing, scent, isn't it? And for some people, one person's delicious scent is another person's, oh my gosh, that smells like damp washing that's been left too long or something.
Yeah.
I find that with Hoyas particularly, that some people find certain scents just really unpleasant, ones that I quite enjoy.
And, you know, that reminds me of lilies. You know, some people love the smell of like stargazer lilies. To me, it's a funeral flower. You know, don't hate me. I love them outside. I do, but I don't want them in my house. The gardenia is pretty strong. So some people don't like that, but I don't know. It just brings, some of it just brings back good memories of other things. Takes you right back.
Indeed, indeed. And those are definitely two qualities we can appreciate, scent and also length of flowering. I guess the other thing is there are certain houseplants which require certain conditions, can we say, to bring them into bloom. I think we're getting onto the subject of photoperiods here. This does potentially make things more complicated and perhaps counts against some of these plants. Tell me what a photoperiod is and what it means for certain houseplants that are ruled by this for their flowering.
Photoperiodism is the, you know, amount of light that a plant gets. So there are short day plants, there's day neutral plants, or day length indifferent, or there's long day plants. So, you know, our long day plants are the ones that want as much light for as long as possible, like 12, 13 hours a day. And that's most of our annuals, marigolds and all those plants outside that bloom, all your annuals that bloom all summer long. And then you have like the short day, and they bloom as the days get shorter and the nights get longer, which really doesn't make any sense, right? Poinsettias, cyclamen, Kalanchoes, all your holiday cactus, your rhizomatous, you know, begonias that bloom in January. And I think that it's also the change in daylight, but it's also the change in temperature is a different, it makes a difference too. It's getting cooler in the fall. Cause I'm like, well, why wouldn't your plants that bloom in the spring as the days get longer? Why isn't that? Why don't they get mixed up? But it's because, you know, it's getting warmer in the spring and cooler in the fall. I think that makes a difference. But I have a friend right now who just sent me a picture and she goes, why is my cyclamen blooming right now? Isn't it supposed to be resting? It's summer. I'm like, I don't know. You've got me. I have no idea.
I've seen so many people with Hippeastrum, aka Amaryllis, flowering this summer.
Yeah.
I'm saying, what's going on? I said, I have no idea.
No idea. I don't know why it's doing that. I mean,
yeah,
maybe they're as mixed
strange.
Up as our weather is in this world. I don't know.
Maybe. I do love those plants that build up to that big crescendo.
Yes.
Around a time when perhaps everything else is looking a little bit sad. I got so much joy this Easter this year when my Easter cactus finally flowered after several years. And everybody who came into the house, including my long-suffering family, I'm just like, look at this. It's amazing. Yeah. I can't believe it's flowered. And everyone's like, oh, yeah, okay. I thought it looked stunning.
I love Easter cactus, yes. And I love holiday cactus. Every year I buy more of them, and I'm like, what am I doing with all these? I put them all in pots up on the west windowsill. But they're face pots, so I want the faces to be towards the room. So probably they only bloom on one side because I didn't turn them. You got to turn holiday cactus to get them to bloom on all sides.
Yeah, that is true. And this is one of my advantages of having a glass roofed room, because I don't have to worry so much about that because they are getting light from all around, which is that's actually quite handy. I think people also can get in trouble with these short day flowers with curtains and things where their plants get blocked from experiencing the normal light cycle by being obstructed an artificial light. Or is that overplayed in terms of its importance, do you think?
I don't think so. I mean, with poinsettias, I've heard that, you know, the people that want them in bloom before they would normally be in bloom, you know, we want our poinsettias at Thanksgiving and our Thanksgiving cactus at Halloween. So, you know, they have it all down, you know, they got curtains to cover or whatever, you know, shade cloths, whatever. And if someone turns the light on in the middle of the night, they got to start all over again with those like 14 to 16 weeks of light, you know, long nights with poinsettias. So I've heard. I wouldn't want to be the person that did that came in and turned on a light or something. But I don't seem to have that problem with, I know people, holiday cacti, but mine are on the windowsill, so maybe they're getting cooler.
Yeah.
But just seem to bloom for me. I don't have a problem with them blooming. But I also, those people that put them in you'll see stuff on Facebook or Instagram. And they're like, well, my poinsettia or my holiday cactus, I just put it in the closet. It's going to stay there for 14 weeks. Mm. I don't know who thinks that something's going to bloom after it's been in the closet day and night for 14 weeks. But
I guess with the holiday cactus, they've been so extensively bred and there's been so much breeding work going on that possibly the stuff on sale now is more adaptable and less fussy than they used to be, I guess.
Probably. I think you're probably right about that.
I mean, it's quite hard to get hold of a Christmas cactus, a true Christmas cactus. I do have some which I managed to get. Unfortunately, they've had root mealybugs, so they're not looking too happy at the minute. But they are really lovely, but they're not easy to buy anymore. You don't see them for sale. It's all these Thanksgiving cacti, which seem to be the ones that are available en masse. And I do love some of those pinky, orangey flowers that they have. The sort of the shrimp colored ones are kind of nice.
Mine are all orange. I'm an orange girl. And there's some people who will not have an orange flower in their garden. And I'm like, orange, pink, yellow, bring it all on.
I agree. We need this kind of color and joy in our lives. Exactly. I mean, are there any other things that you can do if your plant is refusing to flower? What are the other things that hold them back from blooming?
Well, the one thing I have to say first is that fertilizer is not going to make your plant bloom. You know how people are like, oh, it's plant food and my plant's not blooming. I get this all the time. I fertilized it and it's still not blooming. Fertilizer is not what's going to make your plant bloom. It's light. It's all about the light. I mean, it will be healthy. And if you buy a bloom booster, which it's a booster, not a food, and not a bloom maker, it's just going to make your blooms last longer, maybe be bigger, or the stems sturdier to hold them up, whatever. So fertilization is good for your plants, of course, but it's not going to make your plants bloom. So we got that out of the way. So usually it's light. And I tell them it's cyclical. So within a year, if your plant has not bloomed, then it needs something. It needs more light. It needs to get colder. I know I have a couple epiphyllums, not the oxypetalum, just the regular epiphyllums, you know, like the big ones that bloom during the day. Mm-hmm. And I got them from a greenhouse near here where I also got my Christmas cactus. It's a really, really old greenhouse. And she's like, I put those on the shelves, the ledges of the greenhouse. Like she has like eaves troughs running down the sides of the greenhouses that she puts plants in. And some of those epiphyllums literally they're up against the glass in the cold winter of where I live, where the snow can, you know, it can be, it's so cold. And then they just bloom like crazy. So I think that, you know, maybe we're not in our heated homes. It's hard to find a place to keep them cool enough.
Mm.
You know, where they're always the steady temperature. And I think that dip in temperature helps. It definitely helps cacti.
I think that's the thing. Back in the day, one used to have plenty of unheated rooms.
Correct.
Most of the house was unheated, apart from maybe like the kitchen and the parlor or whatever. But now we're used to this very steady temperature, which I guess is why things like Phalaenopsis are so popular, because they do like that very, very steady, like 20 degrees centigrade.
Right.
But yeah, if you've got things like Epiphyllums, as you say, they really need that cold snap to initiate flowering. Is there also an issue with some plants where it's just not old enough? Like there's a maturity issue?
Yes, I was just going to say that. They're not mature enough. Right. So, you know, everybody's like, if you start a, let for this an example, if you start a citrus from like a lemon or orange or whatever from seed, you may not see flowers for over 7 years, you know, or up to 7 years, 5 to 7 years. But yet you may have a cutting from a mature plant that could actually, you know, bloom on that cutting. So yes, your plant has to be mature. And, you know, with that, a lot of people say, well, it has to be root bound. So when I was writing this book, I got in touch with a man from Michigan State. You know, he knew what he was talking about, a professor. And, you know, he's like, yes, root bound. But the point is that when your plant's root bound, it's kind of stressed out. So it's not really that it has to be root bound. It just helps, because any plant that's stressed out is going to try to make more of itself. So how does it do that? It flowers, gets pollinated, and it makes seeds. So that does help, being root bound. I feel like that's my Hoyas are once, and that could also be a maturity thing too, as well, right? Once it's mature, it might be in that pot and be root bound. A dry period, you're going to get a dry period probably, because if it's root bound, you're probably not going to be able to keep it as watered as well as it would like.
And I think there's also, that does vary, because I know with Hoyas, you know, certain of my Hoyas bloomed very young. Like I'm thinking about the one that's given the rather awkward name of Afbertonii, which has got kind of gently fuzzy leaves and butterscotch smelling flowers.
Oh,
and that one of mine bloomed really young. But then Velosa, which I've got from a cutting and is maybe nearly 5 years old, has only just put out its first peduncle, which caused great excitement when I came back from holiday.
I saw that.
So I'm just waiting to see what that's going to look like.
I got one from Logies, which is a really old greenhouse in Connecticut. And it was I think it's Fitchai. And that did, and that was a young plant, but it might have been a mature cutting, right, when I got it. But it bloomed pretty much right away. And I was like, oh, this is amazing, because my Carnosa took forever.
This is the thing, isn't it? You never quite know. The other issue that I want to resolve with Hoyas is those peduncles sometimes seem to just not make it to a full inflorescence. They just drop off. I'm thinking that's probably because I'm a bit of an erratic waterer and they might be sort of aborting because they're not getting enough water. Is that your experience?
I have not. I guess I don't have that. I mean, maybe they fell off and I didn't know, but because I have way too many plants to pay attention too closely, you know, but, you know, the Puba calyx, that's the one I have. I've never had that. I've never seen that happen. But well, doesn't mean it doesn't.
It seems to be a bit of a pattern for me. It also happens with another flowering plant, which now this plant, I guess, is the opposite end of the scale on the scent front, which is a Stapelia hirsuta. And I've been waiting for this plant to, because I know the flower is quite dramatic. I know it stinks,
yes,
but it's quite a dramatic looking bloom that I really want to see. And it about three times this year, it's grown these tiny flower buds and I've gone, yay. And then they've dropped off. But I've now increased the water and I've actually put it in an individual saucer rather than just letting it sit on the tray with all the other cacti. So it's holding a bit more water and the buds seem to have stayed. So I'm wondering if that is it. But
and you know, people ask me what the difference with flowering plants is. Well, any plant doesn't want to be completely dried out. But if you are erratic with the water, which I certainly am, you know, those flowers, if you let it, because I have an Elsobia blooming right now and it is pot bound. I went up there to look at it and it was dry and the two flowers around there had brown edges. And I'm like, oh man. So you got to keep them well hydrated when they're flowering, when they're in bud. Or yeah, they could just say, well, I don't have the energy. I have to use my energy to stay alive. So bye-bye flowers, because I don't have time to make seeds. I got to just even keep alive to even make more flowers.
More from Lisa shortly, but first, some housekeeping and our Q&A. Thanks to all of you who have joined the Patreon clan during the month of August. There were quite a few of you. Emily, Otto, Christine, Claire, Paul, Michelle, Nat and Rachel all became legends. Chloe and Jennifer became crazy plant people and Jessica became a super fan. Thank you so much to all of you. If you want to join that Patreon group, you can access ad-free versions of every episode of the show. Two extra podcast episodes every month called An Extra Leaf and my December mail out. And I'm already thinking about that. I have had some ideas, not quite sure which direction I'm going in. So watch this space. But if you want to find out more about Patreon and other ways to support the show, please check out the show notes at janeperrone.com. And question of the week this week comes from Anna, who emailed me with a double header. The first question being, where can I get variegated Streptocarpus in the UK? Anna was looking for cultivars like Iced Pink Flamingo and Canterbury Surprise. I am yet to find any sellers selling variegated leaved Streptocarpus, I am afraid. I don't think even the famous Dibley's, the North Wales nursery that I love for Streptocarpus, do these. If anyone knows any different, please let me know. Part two of the question involved primulinas and Streptocarpus. Anna wanted to know if there has ever been a Streptocarpus successfully hybridized with a primulina. And again, I was a bit flummoxed on this one, Anna. There are quite a few Gesneriad genera that have been bred together for what we call an intergeneric hybrid, but I'd never heard of these two particular genera, Streptocarpus and primulina, being crossed in that way. I asked around on some Gesneriad groups and hybridizer Derek Johnson was kind enough to get in touch and explain his knowledge of the situation, which is that it doesn't look like it's going to be possible. He points out that people have often tried to cross Streptocarpus and St. Paulia, and it's been tried many, many, many times and that's never worked. Derek goes on to say, it looks like primulina typically has 36 chromosomes, while Streptocarpus have 32. The chromosome number doesn't determine this, but they are likely very distantly related as they diverge from each other long ago. So that basically means that hybridizing them is a huge challenge, if not impossible. I did find a list of intergeneric hybrids that have been produced over the years. This is a publication of the Gesneriad Council of Australia and New Zealand. I'll put a link to this in the show notes. Some of these I'd heard of, some of them I hadn't. For example, there's Codonanthus, which is Codonanthi crossed with Nematanthus. There's also Gloxinmania, which is Gloxinia and Seamania, and Gloxinantha, which is Gloxinia and Smithiantha. And then the names start to get even more confusing. There's Seema Calleria, Seamania and Calleria, and I quite also liked Doltricantha, which is Dolbergaria and Tricantha. I don't think I even know what those two plants look like, let alone the intergeneric hybrids, but there we go. That was a list from 2010, so there may be some more added to it. It's probably got about, I would say about 20 on there from this list from 2010. I also found a great piece on intergenerics by the lovely Dale Martins, who has been on the show before, which explains how Dale creates some of these intergeneric hybrids and lists some of the species involved. I will post a link to that as well because I think you might find it interesting. But short answer, Anna, is no, not for the moment. Although never say never when it comes to plants because science is advancing all the time. If you've got a question for On The Ledge, do drop me a line. It's quite simple. Just email ontheledgepodcast@gmail.com. I did get a number of questions stacking up during my break. I'm endeavouring to get round to as many of those as possible. And if you haven't heard back from me, please be patient. I'll get back to you as soon as I can. If I take more than a month, though, do feel free to send me a nudge. And now back to my chat with Lisa Eldred Steinkopf, talking more about flowering plants. Choosing favourites of anything is hard, but are there any absolute favourite flowering plants that you would recommend to anyone who's a hardcore foliage fan? Which three flowering plants should they be growing?
Well, if you're a hardcore foliage fan, try some of those variegated African violets, you know, the variegated foliage, because, I mean, when they're not flowering, which is they are most of the time, if they're being taken care of correctly, then, I mean, you still have that beautiful foliage. And I do love African violets. Like I said, it was grandma's flower and it's special to me and I love it. Phalaenopsis, I mean, who doesn't? I mean, they just bloom forever and they're so easy. They don't need full sun to bloom. They don't even want that. You keep them, you water them, you take them to the sink, you water them once a week or keep them, you know, they're easy. That's the way I look at it. And then, I really have learned to love these Hoyas that are blooming. So I would have to say those are probably my three favorites. To see that I love, it depends on the time of year. I love holiday cactus. I mean, I love them. They're probably my favorite. And amaryllis. Last year, we own a garden center and some of the amaryllis didn't sell. Well, you think I was going to let those bulbs sit there and rot? No. At one time on my table, I probably had 10 bulbs in flower of these huge, beautiful, you know, flowers. I mean, wow. And that's also easy. All everything you need is right in that bulb already.
Amaryllis are one of those things that they're showstoppers, aren't they? And I think they're kind of good. I like them for Christmas because they remind me of Christmas in that they're a bit kind of ludicrous, a bit over the top. Things can go wrong, but at the end of the day, you're going to enjoy them. Just how I think about Christmas generally.
Yes, exactly. Very much so. But and I don't know about, you know, in England, but do they have the waxed ones? I think those are so interesting.
Yes, yes. I've seen those at the big Dutch flower show. They had all different kinds of waxed ones. I kind of feel quite conflicted about them. On the one hand, I can see people who don't like soil.
Right.
And there are lots of people who just will not have soil in their house. I can see how that would be an attractive option. But at the same time, I kind of, as a sort of a minimalist pragmatist of the houseplant world, I think just, you know, why not just get a normal bulb and stick it in a pot?
I know. I mean, and now I've even seen them where they're now, I guess they keep the bulbs, you know, cold in cool storage. And then they have them in, you know, Easter colors. I'm like, oh, come on. You know, like pale pink and lavender. And so they are out, you know, can come out later. I'm like, I don't know about that. But I did see one that was like frosted and it was on a little log and it had some greens on it. And I'm like, oh, that's so pretty. So I gave in.
Yeah, I can see. I mean, this is how the growers get us, by realizing that, you know, there are these gimmicks which are going to appeal. I think the good thing about amaryllis is the range of cultivars that are available now is way better than it used to be. I mean, I do love the big bright red one and the apple blossom one that used to be the two amaryllis that you'd get.
Yes.
That was basically your choice, wasn't it? The big red one or the apple blossom.
Red lion and the apple blossom, yeah.
Red lion, that's it. But now there's some really quite delicate spidery ones out there, which are kind of fun.
Like the cybester or whatever they're called. Yeah, those are very cool.
Yeah, and you can display them in kind of unusual ways. And I think if you've got children or grandchildren around, or even just curious adults, like, they are a spectacle watching that bud emerge from that massive bulb. I mean, who needs TV?
Right. I give a lot of amaryllis as gifts. And, you know, I've had friends in, you know, nursing homes. Older friends, you know, all you do is you just water it. And even if you gave them the wax one, they're going to get flowers and they're going to last for quite a long time. And how fun for them to watch them grow. I mean, you can practically watch them move and grow. They grow so fast. So it's a wonderful gift.
I have to admit, though, I have a patchy track record with getting them to bloom again. I oftentimes think, oh, yes, I'm going to put them out in the greenhouse, and then they get forgotten. In fact, I just found one the other day that I'd taken out of the greenhouse when we had our heat wave because it was so hot, and put it somewhere else. And I've only just found it. I'm like, oh, darn. I'm not sure this is going to make it.
Well, I did actually do that, and they still have leaves. I did take them out there, but I haven't had a great, track record getting them back to bloom either, but I haven't really put a lot of effort into it because we do own a garden center and there's going to be bulbs left at the end of the year. Isn't that terrible? But I have all those ones that bloom. They're out there and they still have green leaves. So we'll see how it goes.
Yeah. Well, hopefully you'll get some result out of those. I mean, I always try and grow paper white narcissi. My husband, though, going back to scent, absolutely hates the scent. He thinks it's evil.
Oh, mine too. He makes them take them out. he thinks the cat has peed someplace. And I'm like, no, it's those flowers. He goes, oh, really? You got those in here? I'm like, out the door they go. They do smell awful. But there's some that don't. I just never seem to find those ones. It is fun to watch those grow.
It's the limited varieties that are available, I think, that holds us back somewhat on those. But, I would agree with your top three. I think maybe that I might substitute the moth orchids with some kind of, well, maybe with my flame violet, the Apicia. The thing about that, though, is am I growing it for the flowers or the foliage? And I have to say, in my heart of hearts, much as I love the little bright red, lipstick red flowers, I think I might be growing them more for the foliage because the foliage really is stunning. But they are a double whammy kind of plant that I really enjoy growing.
I mean, I'm a big fan of all gesneriads, columnias, ascananthus, streptocarpus, all of those are amazing.
We're going to go deep into those in our Patreon episode. I'm looking forward to that. But yeah, I mean, do you find Apicius? Have you grown Apicius? Do you find them easy? Because I find them strangely easy, despite the books saying they're hard. I always wonder is it something weird here that I find them easy to grow?
I don't think they're hard. You can't let them dry out and they get all the crispy things. And then they kind of get, and if you have the ones that are really pink, that are like Cleopatra, that are more pink than and white, you have to grow those in a terrarium, I found.
Oh, that's interesting. I don't have any of the really pink ones, and the ones I have seem to grow fine just in normal air. In fact, they're growing in pots with no drainage, and that works for me because as a mean waterer, if they had pots with drainage, they probably would be dead.
I probably shouldn't try that myself. I always tell everybody, it has to have a hole in it. But I, for new plant parents, I think a hole is imperative. But if you're a seasoned plant parent, you probably can look. I mean, like you and I can look at my fern and tell you if it's dry or not just by the color of the leaves. So we can know a little more about the plant and what it needs.
Yeah, it's just observation, isn't it? Really, that's the key.
I tell you, anybody can have a green thumb, because today my physical therapist said I have a black thumb. I go, but you could make it green. It's all about paying attention to the plant.
Yeah, exactly. We don't like any of that negative talk around here. What happens after flowering? This is, I think, where people get a little bit scared when the flowers, on some plants like, I guess, moth orchids and, well, a lot of the gisneriads, they don't necessarily the flowers don't just drop off. What do you do? Are you a religious deadheader, or do you just let things
I should be.
Drop and fall?
If I had just maybe 10 or 15 or even 100 plants, that'd probably be pretty easy. But I try to keep up, especially with the African violets and stuff, because you want to keep those dead leaves picked off, because that's a good place for, insects to come, fungus to start. It's just better to keep your plants cleaned up. What is your, on the moth orchid, are you a cut it all the way down when it's done, or do you cut it to the second node or the node right below the last flower and let it go again?
I'm a kind of look at it and on the spur of the moment choose between the two. I don't religiously do either. I mean, sometimes you look at it and think this just needs a break and I'm going to cut it right back to the base and give the plant a break to recover. Because they do flower for such a long time. You think actually the plant needs a chance.
Right.
But sometimes, like a lot of people, I end up rescuing an orchid from, the supermarket that's been put in the 10p shelf and is going to get chucked out, so you rescue it, and sometimes with those I might just cut that stem back to one of those scaly points and see if it will regrow.
Right, because it probably would have bloomed longer had it been so it still has some energy in there.
But I mean, I'm quite brutal. If I think to myself, oh, I've only cut back a little way, and then I just get fed up with it, I will just then cut back harshly.
I cut it back because, you know, I tell people I went to Longwood Gardens and I went to it was orchid month or whatever. And they had seminars and I went to one and they're like, you know, you're just flowering it to death. It's better to cut it all the way back and let it put all this energy into next year's flower. So that's what I do. But I say, you know, do whatever works for you. I used to be very, you know, black and white. And now I'm kind of like, do if it works for you. If you don't want to have drainage in your pot, go for it. If it works for you. Who am I to tell you what to do?
I mean, especially with flowering, because there really is no wrong answer with that one. Like, I mean, I'm always fascinated by this, you know, the way we worry about pruning plants. And in nature, presumably that stem would just sit there until it was completely brown. And then it would eventually get knocked off or pulled off or blown off sometime later without any of this concern.
Correct. I have a couple right now that I was maybe going to do a reel about that have brown stems. I'm like, I think it's time to cut those off.
Well, so. Yeah, I mean, in a way, at least the plant's getting a chance to kind of withdraw all of the nutrients that are in there for itself. And
I will leave it up till it's brown. I'm not going to cut it down so that it reblooms again, but I will wait for it to get brown because even though it's a little tiny piece, it's still green and photosynthesizing for the plant, right?
That's very true. Well, I think that pretty much covers all of my flowering houseplant queries. Is there anything else that we haven't mentioned that we should be noting for newbies to the world of flowering houseplants?
You know, just make sure you have the right light. And if you don't, like a peace lily, I mean, mine's in my bathroom, the guest bathroom. It has a window, but it's about 3 feet from it. And the window is onto a porch or front porch. So it's covered and it still blooms. So there is a plant out there that's pretty low light in my opinion. And it still blooms. Mm. So, you know, but just try something, try an African violet, try a, you know, pick up that Phalaenopsis orchid and try to bring it back next year. Even if you use it as, even if you don't, it's cheaper than a bouquet of flowers that are going to be dead in a week.
Yes, this is so true. This is so true. I'm you've reminded me that I'm really desperate to get hold of some variegated African violets, despite the fact I have no time or room for them.
Me either. I know I saw a variegated, someone that was this girl that's here on Instagram and she lives near me and she's like, look at this variegated Phalaenopsis at the local big box, which I try not to buy anything. I try not to buy too much from a big box because we own an independent garden center. But if I don't find it at the independent garden center, I might run to the big box. And I mean, a variegated Phalaenopsis orchid. I had one a long time ago, got water in the middle of it and it rotted. And I was so, so bummed. But sometimes you just, oh, that would be pretty. Variegated.
Yeah.
Because that would even be pretty when it's not blooming.
Yeah, that's very true. That's very true. You don't see many of those unless they're sort of chance discoveries.
Yes.
You have to go to the specialists.
Yes, yes.
Well, it's been a delight to talk to you, Lisa, and thank you for joining me today. And I'll put all the details of your new book in the show notes. It's out this week, I believe, and we will be continuing to bang the drum for flowering houseplants because they are awesome. Thanks so much to Lisa for joining me this week. If you're a Patreon subscriber, you can hear more chat with Lisa Eldred Steinkopf in my Extra Leaf episode, which you'll find linked in the show notes and also available via your Patreon feed. Thanks to all of you who've been enjoying and subscribing to The Plant Ledger, my email newsletter about the UK houseplant scene. It'll be out again on September the 9th, so you can subscribe now if you haven't already to get that edition. What is it? Well, it's news, events, tips, advice, gossip, fun stuff about anything that's happening with houseplants in the UK. If you subscribe, you get a free guide, in-depth guide, I should say. It's very in-depth to how to deal with fungus gnats, the things that work, the things that don't work, the stuff you need to know. If you go to janeperrone.com and click on the Plant Ledger, you will be able to get signed up. I will see you in a week's time for another episode. Can't wait. Until then, may your enthusiasm for houseplants bloom. Bye. music you heard in this episode was Roll Jordan Roll by the Joy Drops, The Road We Used to Travel When We Were Young by Komiku, and Namaste by Jason Shaw. All tracks are licensed under Creative Commons. Visit the show notes for details.